My name is Kipling Primus. I am 60 years old. Today is Tuesday, October 18th, 2022. I'm at StoryCorps Atlanta. I'm talking with Sue Ross about the Atlanta Business League.
And my name is Susan J. Ross, also known as Sue Ross. I am 70 years old. And today's date is Tuesday, October 18th, 2022. We are at StoryCorps Atlanta. I am talking with Kipling Primus, a friend and colleague who we are going to discuss the Atlanta Business League.
And so before we get to the Atlanta Business League, just a little bit about growing up and your parents. If you can do a little bit.
A little bit. Okay. I grew up in the magical city of Atlanta. And I grew up on the campus of the Atlanta University Center. My parents both taught at Atlanta University. My father, Dr. Hubert Ross, taught sociology and African studies at Atlanta University and later at Clark Atlanta after the merger. And my mother taught at the Atlanta University School of Social Work. She had a social work degree from University of Chicago, and had worked in social work in New York with the Child Welfare League of America prior to getting married. And we came to Atlanta in 1960, which was right at the height of the civil rights movement. So my initial Atlanta was a segregated Atlanta. I went to a segregated elementary school. We rode on the back of the bus. But largely, as young people, we were insulated from a lot of the direct conflict with whites, because basically in Atlanta you were on the black side of town. So we grew up in an area with university faculty housing. But a block behind us was the University and John Hope Holmes projects, and that was the first public housing projects for black people in the nation. And so we all went to school together. You know, there was a mixture of incomes and at our elementary school. And we lived and played together. In addition to faculty children living in the area, we were, you know, only a few blocks away from Vine City and Sunset Avenue, where the King family lived and the Bond family. This is a family of Martin Luther King and Coretta Scott King and Julian Bond Other prominent business people in the community lived on Sunset Avenue, and we were right off of Hunter Street, which is now Martin Luther King, and Hunter Street was an important business byway. It was probably the second most important street for black businesses after Auburn Avenue, so there were many black businesses, including Pascal's, La Carousel, nightclub, D&W Diner, Miss Frazier's Cafe Society, Seller Brothers Funeral Home, the Browner Brothers Hair Products,
housing too. It was a lot of Atlanta doctors and dentists lived on.
Lived
Hunter
in the
Avenue.
Area. They lived in the. Yeah, they lived a little further down in Mosley Park. Mosley Park was a wonderful subdivision, and we all used the what was then the West Hunter Branch Library. We all went there after school or on Saturdays, and so it was a good time to grow up. I also was able to participate in the civil rights movement through the integration of the schools. I guess the Atlanta school system was integrating by the top down. They were going to do the senior class 1 year, and then the 11th grade the next year, and the 10th grade the next year. And there was a lawsuit, they ended up integrating all of them at once after the second year. So I went my ninth grade year, I went to O'Keefe High, and then we moved out to Southwest Atlanta, and I went to Southwest High School. So was able to I grew up living next to Julian Bond's father's house. So the many of the SNCC people were over all the time, and we heard stories of what they were doing in Alabama and Mississippi, and they would come home and tell us how many times they'd gone to jail that week and how many people they had registered and that sort of thing. But it was an exciting time to grow up, and it was a time of profound change in Atlanta. So that the Atlanta I grew up in is the same Atlanta that I came back to when Andy Young became mayor. Well, actually, first when I was in graduate school and we helped Maynard Jackson become the first black mayor of the city of Atlanta. And then after I was in after graduate school, I came back to Atlanta and I was in worked for Andrew Young, who was the second black mayor. He had been the U.S. ambassador. And then I worked for the next five black mayors. Mm-hmm. So.
And Sue, where did you go to school? And I mean, you grew up on a college campus, so mm-hmm. I'm sure you knew you were probably going to college. Was that a given?
It was a given that I was going to college. Yeah, I went to elementary and high school in Atlanta, but when I went to college, my junior year in high school, my father had a sabbatical year, and he did a fellowship at the UCLA African Studies Center. And so we lived in Los Angeles for a year. And while I was there, I was exposed to a number of campuses in California. And one set of colleges stood out to me, which was the Claremont colleges, because they were just like the AU Center. There were, five undergraduate schools and a graduate school and a theological center. So it was similar to the AU Center, except they were rich and white, you know. But I thought I would try that. You know, the black students came out and recruited us. I did not know at the time there were only about 50 to 100 of them on the five campuses, but I soon found out after I got there. But it was good, too. I was able to participate in the black studies movement, the push for black studies centers and for increased black enrollment it was a exciting time to be in Southern California with all that was going on with the Black Panthers and Angela Davis and all of that was happening during that time. And when I came back to Atlanta and Andy Young told me it was time for me to put my political science degree into practice, then I started working for the city of Atlanta. And that really brings me to working with the Atlanta Business League, because I think the second year that I worked for Andy, Shirley Franklin, who was the chief administrative officer for him, asked if I would go to the Minority Business Program and work with that. And I became the deputy director of the contract compliance program for the city. And one of our partners was the Atlanta Business League. So regularly went to Atlanta Business League meetings, served on committees, worked with the presidents of the league, worked with Alice Bussey, who is kind of we call her the grandmother of the Business League now, but she was always a force for advocating for blacks in business and particularly black women businesses. She even challenged the mayor earlier today on the phone conversation about what he was doing for black women businesses in particular. She's a very fierce advocate for black and women businesses. And that gave me the opportunity to work with the Atlanta Business League. So I actually eventually served on the board for several years. The city officials were like ex officio board members participated with Alice Bussey and her committee in forming Super Tuesday, the initial Super Tuesday, which has now been going on for some
38 years.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a long
time.
Isn't
that amazing?
That's amazing. you know, it continues to be a strong force advocating for the needs and, of minority businesses in Atlanta and around the nation.
So why was that important in the mayor's office? Because I can understand them sending representatives, but why was it so important in the mayor's office to be more than just going to the meetings, to actually get involved? You served on the board, you were on committees. You know, why was that important in the city of Atlanta?
Well, it's the office I was in, the Contract Compliance Office, monitored the city's minority and female business program and also the city's equal employment opportunity programs. You know, this was kind of where the groundbreaking work that Maynard Jackson had done in saying that we were not going to build a new airport unless we did it with minority businesses. Well, that all had to be codified and put into a program and administer it. And it had to have some teeth in it. And that's what we did. And we reviewed every contract before it would be signed by the mayor to see what the level of minority and female business participation was, to work with businesses to improve their participation if necessary, to work ahead of time to prepare minority businesses to bid on city contracts or to prepare to be subcontractors. And that because many businesses at that time were primarily in the residential or light commercial sector, and moving into public contracting was a different kind of business, so they needed different kinds of training. As a matter of fact, the last 10 years I was in city government, I was over a small business program training small and minority businesses to do work on the massive watershed program, the program to rebuild Atlanta's water and sewer infrastructure. And that's a heavy construction industry, and that's something that requires even more intense skills. So we did a 12 to 15-week training program and trained hundreds of businesses in preparing them to be ready to be primes and subs on
the work that was
on the
needed.
Work that was done. So it was important for us as administrators to be involved with the minority business community. We frequently would speak about what were upcoming contracts and what were the have workshops on how to become registered with the city, how to become certified, how to make sure you owned your company, looking at the legal aspects of it, how to prepare supply bids or contract bids. And so to do that, you know, it was necessary for us to be involved with the minority business community. And so, in some ways, you say that the city's minority and female business program was kind of like our that was our ministry, you know. It was our way of giving back to the community, of making sure there were minority businesses, that they actually did the business that they were hired to do, that they actually performed work that was relevant to those contracts, that they weren't just trying to collect a check, as happened in some other jurisdictions. We had a very rigorous certification program where we businesses had to show what their ownership was and show that the minority owner owned over 50% of the business and had the authority to make decisions on behalf of the business, which is another very important factor in whether or not the minority owner really owned the company. So that was So as part of the city's outreach to minority businesses, because we were always looking for new businesses to participate in the program, we're looking for businesses to partner with the Business League in providing training opportunities for the businesses that were with them, looking for new ways that we could bring minority businesses into areas that had not been, you know, in the initial program under Maynard was dealt with contracts at the airport. But the program was gradually expanded to other areas of city contracting, and then it was gradually expanded across the range of city contracts. And, you know, when you look at it, before Maynard Jackson became mayor, less than 1% of the business done by the city went to
minority
and women businesses. And, you know, this program was as important for women-owned businesses as it was for minority businesses, because women-owned businesses did not get anything at that time. They had 0% of city contracts before Maynard came into office. And Maynard was also instrumental, and Andy after him, in ensuring that the boards of major corporations in Atlanta were integrated and that there was minority and female participation on the corporate side and in the workforces of the companies that would get contracts into the city. So he went and told the banks, you know, if you want to have city dollars, there was basically an arrangement where the banks would rotate the city's money. They would take turns having it because at that time we had locally owned banks. And he said, if you want the city's money, then, you know, you need to show us that you have
diverse employees.
Diverse employees, yeah. And in across the board, have diverse employees, not just in the secretarial pool, but that you bring women into management roles in these companies. So many of the women who are now currently, you know, corporate
titans,
presidents, vice presidents, whatever, owe that to that period of time back in the 70s and early 80s when those programs forced companies in Atlanta to
do the right thing.
Do the right thing to engage. We had what we called the Atlanta way, and that was that we can't grow. The city can't grow unless everybody grows. So we wanted to make sure all sectors were able to participate in the economic largesse of the city, and hoped that they would continue that as they went into their private contracting. Some did, some didn't, but sometimes the partnerships that people developed on a city contract would then be taken to a public-private partnership project or another entirely private development. You know, so you'd see the development of partnerships in real estate and in other areas. You know, so it's it had a wide reach and a wide effect on the economic health in the country. And of course, you know, the black-owned businesses tended to employ more black people, which meant more black families were being fed. And, you know, most of the black businesses that got city contracts had workforces that were 80% to 90% black. And, you know, in those days, this was a black and white city. There were not as many other minorities, although over the course of the 80s, as we became more international and moved into the Olympic period, we got many more types of people in Atlanta and opportunities to expand the pie further.
To expand the pie further, which is something, Sue, one of the things I still don't quite understand is that Mayor Maynard Jackson mm-hmm. basically laid out a blueprint.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't seem like black mayors and other municipalities thought to pick it up or thought to put
it. Well, they had it. There was a group of black mayors that emerged in the 70s and 80s that tried to implement these programs. And some had... Whether these programs survived that initial period depended on the political will of the city. And some cities in Atlanta maintained the political will to have a program, you know, because the programs were challenged in the courts.
Mm-hmm.
We were sued many times by the Associated General Contractors because, you know, if you have 100% of the money, you don't even want to give up 10 or 20%, you know, but... and, you know, every time we were sued, generally in a Georgia court, we were going to lose, you know, when it was a Georgia state appeals court. We really wouldn't win until we got to the federal area. But it was very important to have for example, there was one suit that we lost. And, well, Andy said, well, what are my options? And we said, well, we need to do a disparity study according to the Supreme Court decision. We need to do a disparity study to show the level of discrimination and to come up with formulas by which we are remedying past discrimination. And so we can't have a quota system. We have goals. We'll have a goal-based program. And in the interim, we can only, he said, well, in the interim, until we get that back in place, because it took us about a year to do the study, he said, we will stop city contracting. We will basically only procure those things which are emergencies. And there actually was a committee to decide what was an emergency contract, what procurements should proceed and what shouldn't. But he and the Atlanta City Council had the political will to stop city contracting until we could get the program legal. And then we of course, brought in experts, Ray Brimmer and Ray Marshall and Andrew Brimmer, Ray Marshall, who had been head of the Labor Department, and Brimmer, who had been on the Federal Reserve Board, you know, two eminent people to lead the study, and a whole group of experts on it, including Atlanta's own Danny Boston who was from Georgia Tech. Well, he was actually, I think, at Morehouse at the time, but. In any event, many cities didn't have the political will to do that, so they just dropped the programs. You know, many cities, you didn't have people with the political base to enable them to do that. You didn't have the strength of minority businesses that you had a tradition of minority businesses in Atlanta going back to, you know, the period of Reconstruction.
The establishment of Atlanta's Business League was 90 years ago. So.
Right. So you had a tradition of black businesses in Atlanta and strong black businesses. So you had banks, you had insurance companies, you had construction companies. And even though much of the work that the construction companies did initially was residential, they built housing for black people. You know, they built
Collier Heights.
They built, the whole Atlanta housing coming from the Fourth Ward area down Hunter Street, going out. And getting to Collier Heights, you know, you had that, and those were companies that were, you know, that did basic construction and could move into
commercial construction easily.
But you know, in many cases, they needed some assistance in the process, and this program gave them that assistance. The ability to keep a strong minority business program was dependent on the political will of the leadership of the city. Yeah.
And the Atlanta Business League, you mentioned the Atlanta Way.
Mm-hmm.
And the Atlanta Way is when the black leaders and the white leaders and business owners would basically come together mm-hmm. behind closed doors, you know, and they would make decisions about how the city was going to move forward, and everybody would be in agreement, and you come out of the closed doors, and everybody tells the same story, and everybody moves in the same.
Everybody would not be in agreement during the meetings.
But they would come out in agreement. You know, whatever fights took place behind those closed doors, but when the doors open, you know, everybody had the same story to tell, basically.
Basically.
That was the Atlanta Way. But so I'm saying because it's so unique. It is.
I mean, the Atlanta Way is something that was inculcated in black businesses and white businesses through the Atlanta Business League on the black side, through the Chamber of Commerce on the white side. You know, I mean, it was expected that Atlanta businesses would do several things. It was expected that they would give back to the community. And that meant that there was a culture of community service among the Atlanta business leadership that, you know, did not always exist in other cities. And there also was a culture of the black and white business leaders meeting with each other and learning to work with each other. It was a big thing. When Martin Luther King got the Nobel Peace Prize and Atlanta decided to have a dinner to honor him, that was basically a decision of Mr. Woodruff, who was the head of the Coca-Cola company, and he got the other business leaders to go along. But Mr. Woodruff and Mr. Beaufilet Jones, at his executive, I don't know what his title was, but he was basically the person that ran the Woodruff Foundation. And they were people that changed the shape of this city, changed the business community to be open and accepting, so that Atlanta was not Birmingham. You know, Atlanta people, the Atlanta Way was for Atlanta to figure out a way to get together so that we don't have the racial strife that you had in Birmingham, that you don't have the Bull Connor kind of approach. that you make sure the police are not attacking the black community, you know, and that you figure out a way to work together. It was not always pleasant. It was not always something that people just agreed to. You know, it was something that came out of beginning to work together. And a lot of these things emerged out of people working together initially on airport projects. And airport projects ranged from construction to administration to financing the airport. You know, there had to be bond deals, so lawyers had to learn to work together and all. And so, you know, the bottom line was there's more money for everybody if we can share the money. And so let's figure out ways to make it happen. And it was not always, there used to be things like the Hungry Club Forum, mm-hmm. that was run by the Butler Street YMCA, where blacks and whites would meet for lunch, you know, and there would be different speakers from the city or the private sector. But it would be a way that people could work together before we, you know, before we were on the boards of other corporations and things like that. There were ways that people could come together. And there was there was another forum. But anyway, there, you know, ways in which the major business leaders could get together, and the leaders of nonprofit agencies, the universities. You know, you had the greatest collection of intellectual capital, black intellectual capital, you know, probably in the world with the AU Center here. I know the Howard people would dispute that, but
W.E.B. Du Bois was right there AU Center doing all of these studies, mm-hmm. on, you know, race and sociology, mm-hmm. health, even, you know. So you're right. It was almost impossible not to be exposed to education if you were living anywhere in, mm-hmm. black Atlanta, because the colleges were right there. Most Saturdays, as little girls, we were on Spelman College campus doing dance, you know. Yeah. So we were always, mm-hmm. Kind of involved with the AU Center.
And I went to Spelman during this. They had a summer program for high school students. It was a Spelman, Morehouse Spelman Intensified Pre-College Program. And, you know, we lived in the dorms on the college campuses. And, of course, we had a 6 o'clock curfew, but we you could only be out after six if you were going home or you were going to the library. But it enabled us, you know, to be exposed to college-level professors teaching us during the summers. And that gave us the preparation to go off and go to these major universities, you know.
Anywhere else that you wanted to go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the Atlanta Business League story is really the story of Atlanta. I was looking at Skip Gates' documentary, Making Black America, mm-hmm. but he was talking about Booker T. Washington and the mm-hmm. National Negro League, mm-hmm. and the National Negro League is what the Atlanta Business League grew out of before the Metro Chamber even, mm-hmm.
oh,
existed.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this notion of black business, or, you know, black Wall Streets, mm-hmm. is a part of the culture of the country, really, but it's definitely the culture of Atlanta.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
From Auburn Avenue, Hunter Street, mm-hmm. and the universities.
Yes, definitely.
So the Business League has always been in a unique position, but when you talk about women in business, because, mm-hmm. one of the things that people don't want to realize is that a lot of the minority and small business contracts not only supported black-owned businesses, but also women-owned businesses, not, mm-hmm. just black women-owned businesses, but women-owned businesses. But at that time, you know, 38 years ago when you guys were creating Super Tuesday, people didn't really think of business and women in even the same sentence.
Mm-hmm. And even some, a lot of the male black business leaders, you know, I mean, because the I think Alice was the first black woman president of the Business,
yes.
League, but several women have succeeded her. You know, I mean, there have been a number of them who have succeeded her. Rhonda Brown, who was next after Rhonda? Spiller, I think. Anyway, in any event, there have been many women presidents of the business league since that time. But at the time we were doing Super Tuesday, people thought black business meant men, you know. And but there's significant sectors of the business community that have always been owned by women. Women always owned businesses in the hair industry, real estate. You had, you know, real estate. You had Lottie Watkins. You had black women realtors. You had you had black women in public relations firms. You know, if you look at some of the people who cut their teeth doing communications for political campaigns, formed some of the major public relations firms in the city. Sonia Young,
Bonnie Ransom.
You know, those names you have to call. Those are all significant black women business owners in the city of Atlanta. And the Business League provided a way for them to take leadership and to expand their businesses, yeah.
So do you think black women business owners have a unique, is it unique in Atlanta to have this many black business owners? Or are we just more accepted because of the business environment in Atlanta? What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, Atlanta is a special place for black businesses, you know, and if you look at it, and now women are doing businesses in all kinds of, look at Pinky Cole and the Slutty Vegan. She created a brand from a truck and social media and sexy names to create a virtual empire. She came out of Clark Atlanta University, and she has created an empire of vegan, tasty. Because before Pinky, everybody thought vegan food meant blah 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 blah.
Cardboard.
It's not, it doesn't taste good, you know. But she created flavors that even people that like meat would eat, you know. And she created a mystique around it, and because it was such a small, tiny business that you couldn't get but 10 people in that first building she had, and the people would be wrapped around the blocks. They'd be wrapped up.
Even now, it's still a line.
Yeah,
and it's bigger.
And she has multiple businesses now. Now she's got 5 Atlanta locations and locations in other cities. You know?
And her burgers are on the menu at Shake Shack.
Uh huh.
Mm-hmm. You can't get any better.
So, I mean, you know, Atlanta has been a place for people to come and try business ideas. And, you know, if your idea appeals to the public, you've got a chance to make it big here. Yeah.
Now, Sue, you have your own little cottage business, too.
Well, you know, I am not the great business entrepreneur that, say, my brother is. My brother is a big... you know, he has a program management firm and does major contracting with different airports and other infrastructure jobs and stuff like that around the country. You know, I am a photographer, and I do photography as my photography started as a hobby, but it also started at the city because Andy Young decided he wanted to document the things that were going on in his administration, and 3 or 4 of us bought cameras. And while it was not our job, we took pictures. You know. It was our unofficial job, and we were unofficial city photographers. And you know, that I've continued to do that. I've worked with major cultural institutions in Atlanta, with the National Black Arts Festival, with the Atlanta Jazz Festival. And, you know, I've done a lot of cultural documentation of the city over many, many years. And now I'm looking at, you know, how to archive that legacy and make it available to the public, and looking at a book and some big exhibits and things like that. So I guess you could call me a minority business person in one way or another. Although I'm not the photographer necessarily that you hire to do headshots or anything like that.
No, you're a documentarian.
I'm a documentarian, yeah. And so. So, you know, I photography was always what I did to relax from the city, you know, and even when I was doing city events, you know, because you have to do the grip and grin shots. The mayors want the pictures with the shaking hands,
the kissing the baby,
the, you know, presenting the checks. signing the contracts, those kinds of things. But I always tried to look at the human side of each of those events and tried to also get some pictures. I used to have two cameras at most things. I'd have a camera for the city and a camera for me, and I would catch the more intimate things on my camera and catch the official things on the city camera. And although in the beginning it was all my camera, it was my camera. and pretty much, you know, throughout. But it's been, it's given me the opportunity to, being at the city was as I said, Atlanta, growing up in Atlanta was a magical place. But being at the city and participating in the transformation of the city government, the integration of the different areas, you know, and the ability to form public policy to make a difference in areas in your community, you know, to make a difference. I also worked with the Housing and Economic Development Program, with CDBG, worked in with Cultural Affairs a few years, and the expansion of cultural activities around the city. You know, the role of Maynard Jackson, again, looms large in before Maynard was mayor, there were only maybe four institutions that received public funding for the arts, you know, the High Museum, the Alliance Theater, the ballet, and maybe
the opera.
The opera, probably the opera. But Maynard democratized the arts in Atlanta, which made it possible for not just Black institutions to get funding, but community-based arts institutions to get funding. And then they developed a process of funding all types of arts organizations, large organizations at one level, but all the way down to individual artists and communities. You know, that was a major shift in public policy, democratizing the arts so that the city funding did not just go. And for the major institutions that received city funding, they had to also provide. That's when the symphony started doing the concerts at Piedmont Park, because that was part of their outreach to the community, was presenting a few free concerts that everyone could attend, you know, and things that people don't think about now. I mean, you know, those kinds of things. I recall a symphony concert in Piedmont Park where Maynard's aunt, Matawilda, the great
singer,
Matawilda Dobbs, great opera singer Matawilda Dobbs, performed with the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in Piedmont Park.
You have
it
pictures
was incredible.
Seen?
I have a few, yeah.
Yeah,
I have a few, yeah. but it was, I mean, that was, you know, those things, those were magical moments, but they were moments that made a difference for the everyday Atlantan who could
everyone.
Just, you know, drive to Piedmont Park and see the Atlanta Symphony without buying a ticket, you know. When you saw the Alliance Theater do programs that did outreach to the communities, helping to train young people in acting and directing and giving people opportunities to become that, and the CETA program, which actually paid people to do art, you know, similar to the WPA of the 30s, but people who are major stars now, like Samuel L. Jackson and LaTanya Richardson Jackson, who were students at the AU
at
Center.
Clark Atlanta.
Yeah, and LaTanya is, you know, from here. This is home for her. But they, you know, they got their initial jobs through the CETA program and through the Neighborhood Arts Center and being paid to do performances in the community.
And the arts are now a huge moneymaker for the city.
Oh, yes, definitely. Huge economic generator, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sue, we're almost at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Just tell me a little bit about international, because a lot of people think Atlanta Business League is just here in Atlanta, but they have done international trade missions for a number of years.
Yes, and the first one was back in 1989 and really was initiated by Alice Bussey, who was looking for a way to get, you know, looking for a way to expand her business and to develop alternative suppliers, so they weren't dependent on the white companies here in Atlanta to give them what flowers they had left over, you know. So Alice put together the idea of a trade mission. We actually went to three countries. We went to Jamaica and Trinidad and Trinidad and one other country. In any event, we went, but it was a because of Andy's previous experience as a UN ambassador and his work in the civil rights movement, he was a perfect entree to the governments in the Caribbean, and through that came discussions of direct flights between Jamaica and Atlanta and that was a way of the Jamaican flower producers being able to send their products directly through Hartsfield to come to be
sold
in Atlanta. Yeah. So the Atlanta Business League was critical in developing an international outreach because it wasn't something that the city there were trade missions that were largely sponsored by the Chamber of Commerce, and they would go to
Europe
and
maybe Asia.
Maybe Asia, yeah. There was one to, yeah. Then I recall one or two to Asia, but I mean mostly Europe. And so this under Andy, we began trade missions to the Caribbean, and later the governments got involved with sister city programs with African nations. Well, actually, the sister city program started with Maynard, but doing the trade missions came later. And that, there would be actual concrete seminars on, you know, customs and doing contracts, import-export, doing contracts internationally. And out of that came a lot of business for Atlanta companies, both black and white. I mean, it was the Business League sponsored the trip, but the people who went on the trip were not just black businesses. There were black businesses and major Atlanta corporations, you know. So that that was something that expanded Atlanta outreach in an area that was definitely, it wasn't just underserved, it was not served at all before, yeah. So Business League was crucial in expanding the international view of Atlanta. And of course, all those things, you know, led later to us getting the Olympics. Yeah, in 1996. Yeah.
All right, Sue. Well, thank you so much for sharing today. I know we could probably talk more. We could have one whole conversation about you growing up on Clark College campus.
truly.
Thank you for today. I do appreciate your time.
Okay, and I thank you for this. Has been a wonderful conversation and interview, and it's been. I thank StoryCorps also for allowing us to record it here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.